There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.
Hello and welcome to the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast, a roundup of the best bits of today's show from Monday, the 27th of January.
And amid the celebrations for Chinese New Year around the world, there is, of course, the very real impact of what is happening, not just in China, but in other countries as well, with the spread of the coronavirus. Let me bring you up to date on where we are this morning. We do have a new case that has been confirmed in Australia, in Sydney. A young woman there has been confirmed to have the coronavirus. That is Australia's fifth confirmed case. There are adults being tested in Western Australia as well.
Looking at some of the implications that this could have, obviously, for tourism across the world, and we're looking at it here in Dubai as well, there are many, many implications.
There are indeed. Look, we are going to hear from the senior manager of a massive tourism company here in Dubai, what it is meant for the Chinese New Year here. We're also going to be speaking to one of the companies helping to fight the coronavirus, a maker of decontamination units. But before we do that, let's get the official news on what is actually happening in the UAE to protect our borders. Dr. Fatima Al-Attar is the Director of International Health Regulations at the UAE Ministry of Health and Prevention. She has been speaking to us this morning to explain what the UAE is doing.
I'd like to assure the people that the Minister of Health, in coordination with all health authorities in UAE, had implemented the necessary preventive and control measures to protect emerging the disease to the country, and we are fully prepared to deal with any eventually concerning the new virus found in terms of equipment, laboratories, training of the healthcare workers, and raising the awareness of the public.
What can you tell us about the plans that you have in place?
Yeah, first of all, we disseminated medical guidelines to the healthcare workers, so to know what is the definition of the disease and how to diagnose it, how to deal with the case, how to protect themselves. This is very essential. And we also increased the awareness of the public in terms of health educations and how to protect themselves. In different languages, for sure. We post it in social medias, in different channels, to avoid creating any panic in the community. Other things, as a measurement, we prepared our airports and points of entries to be ready for any concern.
What will medical officials be looking for at the borders?
Actually, we implemented the best practice have been done on the other international airports by using the thermal scans for the arrival from the affected country, and we ensure on the same time the smoothly movement of the passengers without disturbing any. Any person found to have high temperature have been moved to the medical airport center for further investigation. And I am quite sure to say that, thanks to God, till date, no case of new coronavirus found in the UAE.
And what coordination are you doing with international bodies, such as the World Health Organization?
Yeah, our national WHO focal point is in contact 24/7 with the WHO for any update and any measurement to be taken further.
And you mentioned there, Dr. Fatima, making sure that you had the necessary equipment. What kind of things do you mean?
The most important thing is that we have now the diagnostic kit, the laboratory diagnostic kit, so we can know that this is exactly the virus or it is other kind of viruses. This is very important. The other things, all the personal protective measures, which is important for our healthcare workers in case they are dealing with the actual case, so they can protect themselves. These are the equipments that we ensure that it is available for the time being.
And that is Dr. Fatima Al-Attar, Director of International Health Regulations at the UAE's Ministry of Health and Prevention.
So, what does all this mean for us here in the UAE? We are the Business Breakfast, so looking at the business implications. One, of course, is the oil price, and we've been covering that extensively. But the second one is tourism. Dubai has made great efforts over the past few years to promote the UAE. Dubai is a destination for Chinese tourists, and it's been successful. Almost a million Chinese visitors last year. And this week, Chinese New Year, is when the hoteliers are saying Gong Hei Fat Choi to try and roll out the red carpet, literally, figuratively, for Chinese visitors. Divyesh Kumar is the senior manager at Orient Tours. It's a travel company that, in many ways, helps to bring Chinese tourists into Dubai and organise tours for them. We asked him, first of all, how important this time of year is for inbound Chinese tourism.
Well, that brings in, for the Chinese customers coming into Dubai, that brings in quite a large number, especially during this time of the year. We're looking at the market, source market for tourism into Dubai. We're talking of China being on the fifth position. So there's quite a lot of numbers during Chinese New Year that travel into Dubai.
Bookings then were strong for this week in hotels across the city. What kind of cancellations has he seen?
We had the bookings between the 20th of this month till the 30th. These are the 10 days of travel for the Chinese tourists into the region. We were handling approximately about 5,000 bookings, which means just not the whole package, but in terms of all the attractions, the restaurant bookings and everything. We've seen, as we do a lot of individual travelers and not large groups, we've seen a drop of about 300 or 400 cancellations out of the 5,000 bookings we were handling.
We've also been speaking this morning to a company, a Finnish company, that is involved in trying to detect and contain the virus. Genarano is a company that makes decontamination units, and Petri Vuolo is their export manager. He's in town because Arab Health starts today. Could you ever have a more timely date for a health exhibition and conference here in the UAE? We spoke to Petri this morning, who is in town for Arab Health, about what they are doing.
We have tried to help China the best we can. We had some units in China which were shipped immediately to the incident zone. We had some units in Finland in stock. Those were shipped to China. And now we are producing more for China at the moment.
We asked him how many of these decontamination units could China need.
Now we are talking about first more than 100 units, but depends on how long this will last and how widespread this will be.
This is the Bite-Size Business Breakfast, exclusively on DubaiEye1038.com.
Let's get some insight on one of our top stories this morning, and that is Dubai's commercial property market getting a boost from an unlikely source. Innovative companies like cloud kitchens, vertical farms, and also e-commerce. That's according to new research from the real estate broker Savills. It says demand for warehouses is strong on the back of this, particularly in outlying areas such as Dubai South. Joining us in the studio to tell us more is the head of the Dubai office at Savills, Murray Strang. Morning, Murray.
Morning.
So what's the story?
So the story is that although it's kind of maybe one of the less glitzy aspects of the market and less of a sort of trophy development sector, I think the performance of the industrial and logistics sector has still been very strong in terms of occupier demand and in terms of occupancy rates. We're often debating quite how the balance between demand and supply affects the market. I was interested to hear Dr. Chris Payne's view last week from Peninsula regarding an actual lack of demand rather than oversupply. And I think, you know, industrial sector actually bucks this trend in that we do see continued growth and good quality demand. And there's not quite the level of oversupply that we see in other sectors of the market, such as new residential towers, commercial towers, retail space coming up ad infinitum. Item, the supply of industrial and logistics property is a bit more muted and a bit more attached to demand levels.
I was particularly struck by two things in particular. One was cloud kitchens and the other was vertical farms. Now, I thought these were still very, very niche globally and here in Dubai, but you say they are beginning to move the needle.
Yeah, I think it's amazing the number of entrepreneurial and kind of first adopter investors that we speak to across the market. And these two sectors of vertical farming and cloud kitchens in particular, we've seen a major spike in the last 12 months of demand for these sectors in terms of sustainability and efficiency of space when it comes to producing food in vertical farming. And also, you know, in terms of quick delivery from restaurants and the Deliveroos and Uber deliveries of this world, access to quick food has led to, instead of being delivered from your average restaurant or F&B outlet, we're now seeing cloud kitchens coming up all over the place, and we're seeing access to that food being much quicker to your door, and that's via sort of last mile delivery via cloud kitchens.
How many cloud kitchens are we actually talking about, Murray? Are we talking about a dozen across Dubai? Are we talking into triple figures? How big is this?
I think there's around kind of 20 to 30 well-established cloud kitchens, but the amount of emerging new businesses with ideas that are talking to hotel chains, restaurant chains, F&B outlets now that have fantastic business plans with heavy growth over the next 5 to 10 years, I think there's a lot of them in the pipeline. Very difficult to put a number on exactly, but I think it's definitely a sector of the market that will see, you know, heavy growth in the next 3 to 5 years. And from an inquiry level at Savills, we see a huge level of growth in terms of, can you find us warehousing, logistics space that suits cloud kitchens?
Well, to quote Newton's third law of physics, for every action there is an equal and opposite reaction. Does this rise in what we might call food tech or cloud kitchens? Are we seeing a reduction in the number of good old-fashioned restaurants that would maybe have delivery as a big chunk of their business?
Yeah, I think it's probably minimal in the F&B outlets, to be honest. I think it's still quite an obvious divide between those that want to sit on the sofa, maybe in their pajamas, watching Netflix and ordering in food from a cloud kitchen, as opposed to those that want to get dressed up to the nines and go to a nice restaurant and actually eat out. There's still quite a big difference there. I think, you know, it definitely adds to your choices and your selections in terms of ordering in. And most importantly for customers, it can now be with you, you know, in 15-20 minutes instead of having to wait for a restaurant to queue your order and then it arrives an hour later and actually you could have made something yourself. So it's similar to what we see on the e-commerce side of things. You know, it's the old argument, you know, are people going to stop visiting shops and using traditional retail because they can order in from e-commerce? I think there's probably more of a concern there on the retail side of things because it is either or. But for the food side and the cloud kitchen, I think really it's just improving efficiency for those trying to order in food.
Yeah, people asking us, cloud kitchens. What Murray's talking about, if you've just joined us, is what in the UK is often known as dark kitchens. It is kitchens for restaurants that don't have restaurants attached. It's where a lot of the delivery food that you will be ordering will come from. Talk to us about location for that though, Murray, because as I understand it, for the model for Uber Eats and Deliveroo, etc., when they open up these kitchens, they want them to be in a specific location to serve specific neighbourhoods that otherwise might not have, you know, this type of Chinese or pizza or whatever.
Yes.
How does that dovetail with where our warehouses currently are in the free zones?
Yeah, I think it's this question of last mile delivery, which has been hugely important with the sort of growing availability of goods and e-commerce. And I think that's why there will be a continued demand for a spread of different locations across Dubai. For industrial and logistics property, I think people often think of JAFSA and Dubai Investments Park, but it's why we've seen continued demand for the central location of Al Khawz. We've seen up at Ras Al Khor and DAFSA up towards Old Dubai in the creek. And I think it's all about, like you say, closeness and accessibility to
hot pizzas,
to residential communities, and there will be demand, and you won't be able to drive food and hot pizzas from JAFSA up to up to Old Dubai and the creek. So it's about having warehouses, you know, and you would be surprised now quite how close to different locations right across Dubai these cloud kitchens are becoming. And if you imagine the cost efficiencies of being able to run an industrial kitchen and very quick in and out specifically for deliveries against having to lease prime restaurant space, kitchens at the back of restaurants, the cost efficiency is absolutely huge.
30 seconds on what it means for landlords. What kind of yields can I get at the moment if I want to buy warehousing space in some of the areas that you mentioned?
Yeah, similar to other markets, the industrial yields are high. So you can see yields of 8 to 10% quite easily, sometimes in the double figures. I think the challenge with industrial property is being able to find land that's on either freehold title or long enough leasehold title for investor comfort, because some areas such as Alcoz and Jaffsa and other areas are short-term leasehold land only. So it's about finding those pockets where investors are comfortable investing long-term, but the yields are definitely there to make it appealing.
Mary Strang, great talking to you as ever. Thanks very much for joining us today. Mary Strang, head of the Dubai office at Savills.
Catch up on the business headlines with the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast.
Tributes are flowing this morning for Kobe Bryant, who was killed in a helicopter crash at the age of 41 just outside Los Angeles. The Grammys, which are currently being held at the Staples Center in LA, which is his team, the Lakers' home stadium, are obviously exceptionally Kobe-focused. People like Lizzo dedicating their performances to him. Alicia Keys, who has been speaking at the event, reducing the audience to tears with her tribute this morning.
Let's hear from Kobe Bryant now. This is him, not on the basketball court, but in an Oscar-winning performance. His letter to basketball, Dear Basketball. He wrote the letter when he retired from the game a few years ago, and it was made into a short animated movie that won an Oscar.
Dear Basketball. From the moment I started rolling my dad's tube socks and shooting imaginary game-winning shots in the Great Western Forum, I knew one thing was real. I fell in love with you. A love so deep, I gave you my all. From my mind and body to my spirit and soul.
Tributes pouring in from the world of sport and not just basketball. India's cricket captain Virat Kohli has reached out on Instagram and says, absolutely devastated to hear this news today. So many childhood memories of waking up early and watching this magician doing things on the court that I would be mesmerised by. Life is so unpredictable and fickle. That is Virat Kohli, the Indian cricket captain.
Yeah, and Tiger Woods as well. This is him speaking to reporters just minutes after hearing the news, after he walked off the golf course.
I didn't know until Joey just told me coming off 18 green. I didn't really understand why the people in the gallery were saying doing it for Mamba. But now I understand. It's a shocker to everyone. Unbelievably sad, and one of the more tragic days that I think, well, for me, it's just, the rally just kind of sitting in because I was just told probably about, 5 minutes ago.
Yeah. You've been a Lakers fan your entire life. I know what Kobe meant to you. Joe LaCava says that you guys talk about him a lot on the golf course. What will you remember most about him as a player, but most importantly, as a man and father?
The fire. He burned so competitively hot, and the desire to win. He brought it each and every night on both ends of the floor. I mean, not too many guys can say that throughout NBA history that he'd lock up on D. Obviously, he was dominant on the offensive side, but anytime he was in the game, he'd take on their best player and just shut him down for all 48 minutes. And that was one of the more impressive things, I think, throughout this entire career. And then, when he ruptured his Achilles and went to the foul line and made his shots. I mean, that's tough.
Yeah, definitely one of those players who transcends his own sport. It's not just basketball fans this morning who are in shock of someone very much regarded as a legend.
He had a very strong following, of course, in the Middle East, where basketball is incredibly popular, particularly here in Dubai. Back in 2013, he visited Dubai and he played basketball with a number of people, including our colleague Chris Fade from the Chris Fade Show on our sister station, Virgin Radio Dubai. Chris has joined us in the studio to share his memories of not only playing basketball with Kobe Bryant, but also off the court, sitting down, having breakfast with him and getting to know the man.
What horrible news to wake up to. I sort of woke up in the middle of the night around midnight and I just had a look at my phone for some reason. I saw it and I thought I was dreaming. 41 years old, his beautiful 13-year-old Gianna in the accident as well. Seven others on the way coming out of Calabasas, north of Hollywood. And the helicopter's gone down. Supposedly an older helicopter from like early 1990s. He was in Dubai. He was in Dubai back in 2014, had an opportunity to play basketball with him. He was our coach. We played the 1986 Spanish Olympic team at, I think it was AUS, and we're a remarkable man on the court and off the court. You know, I was a fan of him, obviously, as one of the greatest basketball players of all time, but then to hang out with him, went and had breakfast at the atmosphere at Burj Khalifa, spent a bit of time there and then played the game, and he was just a gentleman and a real cool guy. I remember me and a few of the colleagues that were playing on the team were just looking at each other going, we can't believe how nice he is, you know, like just so warm and so generous, and the fans would come up to him at the end of the basketball game. There was no security, but everyone just sort of got out of the stadium and sort of started running up to him. And he was so cool, like just taking photos with everyone. He was truly a great.
What were you chatting about over breakfast?
Just about like when you're chatting to someone like Kobe Bryant, and I'm a huge fan of basketball and Kobe, we were talking about Dubai, really, just telling him, because he was like, man, this city's beautiful, as we're on the top of the tallest tower in the world having breakfast. And we were just really talking about Dubai and, you know, his experience. It was the first time he was here. He was excited to play this celebrity match as well. And then we were just talking about his own career as well. He had a few injuries back then. We're talking about his injuries. But just overall, he was just so amazingly cool, and I can't believe it. I can't believe at the age of 41, I said on my Instagram earlier today that, you know, I gave my girls a couple of extra kisses this morning as I left them, because, you know, you just never know where life is going to take you. He's on the top of his, you know, he's got all the money that he wants. He's got a beautiful wife, a beautiful family, and it's all taken away with him within seconds in this helicopter crash.
And there you go. That's Chris Fade from our sister station, Virgin Radio Dubai, with his memories of Kobe Bryant, and that reminder there to love the ones who love you.
Just the highlights. This is the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast.
Let's talk urban planning, because Dubai has launched a scheme. It's called Soft Mobility, to transform great swathes of the city. Joining us in the studio to give us some more perspective on this is the Vice President for Design, Planning and Economics at the engineering giant AECOM, Yanis Rostock. Yanis, good morning. Thanks for being with us.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
So the RTA has announced this plan. They're calling it Soft Mobility. Things like walking, cycling, electric scooters. In simple terms, what's your understanding of what soft mobility means? And then we'll get on to why the RTA is doing this and how it might change Dubai.
So soft mobility is everything not to do with cars. So it is the walking, the cycling, the e-scooters, hoverboards, whatever is going to come in the future, of different alternative modes of transport to the car.
So we understood this as being almost the kind of last mile stuff. It's all well and good having a metro station 1.5 kilometres from your apartment block, but in July it's really, really hot. So how do you get between the apartment block and the metro station? And then perhaps you've got a similar problem where you get to your office or your place of work.
Correct. So what we're looking at when designing for the last mile or the first mile is, of course, to ensure that the ease of access from the public transport to your home or to your office. And that can be done in different ways. So this is a plan to look at the softer mobility. There is different types of pods schemes that could be used as well. So feeder buses and all of that you can start using in terms of getting from your home into the metro line. So the metro lines can't feed all of the areas of a city, not at this point in time at least. So getting from your home to the metro has to be done in a very easy and efficient way. It increases the quality of life for the people living there. It increases the lack of, or it reduces the obesity, and it in all ways creates a better city for people.
So I get why we need to do that. Mm. What I'm struggling to understand is how we're going to do it. I know companies like yours, AECOM, when you're master planning a new city, such as these big areas in Saudi Arabia that are being created, you can build this into the design now, and that's fine. But if you're working in an area like Mankul or Al-Ghusais or Barsha that's already been there, and the roads are already too narrow and the pavements are already too narrow, how do you put these things in place when you've got all these constraints?
So the big challenge there, of course, is that something's got to give. So many of the roads in the UAE are fairly wide in design. If you're comparing to old cities in Europe, for example, that have been designed during the Middle Ages, of course, they're much narrower than what we've got here. So for us, it's about looking at the different rights of way, maybe reducing the rights of way, looking at the parking. How can we now remove some parking? So increase the serviceability for the pedestrians, the cyclists, and maybe reduce a little bit for the cars. So this is about encouraging people to get away from the car and onto public transport.
What needs to be done from an infrastructure point of view for this to happen? I mean, we've got absolutely fantastic cycling lanes out in Al Qudra, for example, but they are recreational cycling lanes. You're not using them to commute to work.
No, I think the biggest challenge in the existing parts of the city, of course, is that you're mixing the softer mobility with cars, trucks, buses, and all of that. And what you've got to make sure is that it's a safe route. So for us, it's about segregating the traffic. It's about segregating pedestrians and cyclists from the cars, and that has to happen in an orderly way. The challenge in a gridded city is that you have to cross a lot of roads along the way. So part of this is going to be designing the sidewalks and these cycle tracks in a way so that they can cross the roads. I think there's elements of education as part of this as well, because the pedestrians as well as the car owners needs to have different behaviours.
And behaviour is the one thing that gets thrown up here all the time, whether it's fog or whether it's behaviour at roundabouts, that people say, oh, well, you've got drivers from 100 and whatever countries here all doing things their own way. But even where you don't have that, places like Australia, places like the UK, there is still a huge problem with cars going into cycle lanes. Some countries combat this by having a little raised almost curb between the cycle lane and the road. What could be the answer here? Because safety obviously is going to be paramount.
Safety is paramount. So the way we would design it is to have a raised curb so that you can be absolutely sure that you won't have any cars on the cycle lanes. You also need to segregate pedestrians and cyclists. So I'm from Denmark, and in Denmark we probably have some of the highest cyclists in Copenhagen, at least. So more than 50% of all internal trips of Copenhagen are done on bicycle. The challenge there is that the bicycles believe that they own the roads and they can do whatever they please. And therefore, it's becoming dangerous as a pedestrian to walk next to the cycle lane. So I think this is all about behaviours. It's all about regulating behaviours, and it's all about making sure that people understand that there are certain types of people moving around in the city have priority. So I think for me, it's about moving forward. When you've got a junction with a traffic light, the priority should be given to pedestrians and cyclists to show the cars that these are the people that have priority now.
Let's talk about the weather. We've got just a minute left. Shaded walkways and shaded paths is one of the things that the RTA specifically mentioned, which is a great idea in principle, but the thought of putting shading all across Dubai, and they're going to start with bits of Barsha and Alcaçaz, but then it's going to go across the city. Hugely expensive, is it not, to put shaded cycle paths and shaded walkways here, there and everywhere?
It is expensive, but it's also increasing the quality of life, and it's increasing the brand of the city. So shading doesn't have to be, it could be a tree. So trees are very good at shading open spaces. It's much cooler underneath a tree, even when it's very hot. So if you can reduce the ambient temperature, if you can use the heat radiation from the surfaces by shading them, you create a much better environment.
20 seconds. Economics is in your title. Who's going to pay for this? Can we get to a stage where we're charging people a license to cycle on the roads, a license to use an e-scooter? Is there any precedent for that globally?
There's not a lot of precedent for pedestrians paying for it. Usually it ends up being the cars paying for it. So what you want to do is you want to get people out of the cars into the public transport, because that's better for your city. You can make narrower roads. You can make a lot of less infrastructure by getting people to use public transport and to walk and cycle more.
Yanis, great talking to you. Appreciate your time this morning. Yanis Rostock, Vice President at AECOM Middle East and Africa.
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.